We're going to finish Genesis today. Jeff led us through chapters 1 through 11. We saw the creation, the fall, and the downward spiral of humanity, big picture, the cosmic picture, all of creation, the global picture of the fall of humanity, the fall, Babel. And then in chapter 12, right, there's the focus narrows in really close from the cosmic picture to global picture down very narrowly to one family, Abraham and his family. And we talked about this theme we've seen from the garden and then now looking again as we look at Abraham, of God's special people and God's special place and God's special rule. This is the idea of kingdom. God is making a gracious covenant with the one man. I'm going to see if I can fix my thing here to get away from my light here. I got wobbled. There we go. When you look at Abraham, God's making a gracious covenant with the one man and his descendants, which will bless the entire world. And in this covenant, God has promised to be their God. He promises unilaterally that they will be his special people, that they will live in the place of his choosing, that they will enjoy a unique relationship with him under his rule. That's what we're going to kind of think about today. We see that in the garden lost, and now God is bringing this back into being. God's special people brought to God's special place under God's special rule. All right, so that's what we talked about last time. We have this family, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, with a focus on Joseph. And now we're going to dig in for the rest of our hour this morning and just look at this family, what God did here. This should be fairly familiar to you. Obviously, I just preached through the life of Abraham, so that should be really familiar to you. But even the stories of Isaac and Jacob are very familiar stories to us. So we're going to go slow because these are really foundational. We're going to review them again. And we'll start picking up speed. I think we'll have two classes on Exodus, and then we'll start picking up speed because these are such foundational ideas for us to think about. All right, so let's jump into Abraham. When we think about Abraham, what are some of the big things you think about when you think about Abraham? All right, we're going to talk about that, right? Declared righteous through his faith. Rob?
Isaac.
Oh, right. What do you think about with Isaac, his son? Right. What's special about that? What's that? All right. Okay. We're gonna talk about that too. So these, some of these big things, these are big events in his life. And when they think of the father of the faith, why was he the father? Was he special? We don't see anything special about him. What was special about him is God chose to make a covenant with him. And I think the big thing when you think about Abraham, things happen and he responds because of God. But the big thing you think about is God's prerogative, is God's covenant. And that's what's highlighted throughout the life of Abraham, right? You have these three big sections in 12, 15, 17. God keeps coming back to these promises and covenants to highlight God's works. When you think of Abraham, think covenant. God is making a covenant with him. He's laying out the blueprint for the way of salvation. So we're going to think for a little bit about, and we're going to hit a lot of those little topics, but we're going to think about this great covenant. The first was a promise in Genesis 12, right? This is the first sermon. It was about right at the beginning. This is God calling Abraham to go to this land. Yahweh says to Abram, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you. And I will make your name great, so that you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and those who curse I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. All right, so we see this, and we're going to see it again in chapter 15 and chapter 17. And we'll see parts of it there. Just to remind you, this is God's great promise. But we're thinking about the theme, God's special people and God's special place under God's special rule. Let's see what we can learn about those things as we look through these different lives. So, Abraham, what would we look here and learn about with God's place? Where is God's special place? Do we know where it is at this point? What do we know about God's special place? Well, it's promised, right? But he doesn't know. And that's really an important piece there. God says, I'm going to take you to a place, but you don't have to know where it is. He says, I'm going to take you where the land which I will show you. We know that's going to be Canaan, ultimately. But that wasn't an important point to God. God wasn't saying, making sure you know where I'm going. No, just follow me. I'm going to show you where I'm going. So the God's place is wherever God leads them. The place where God will show them. Now, we know that's leading to Canaan, But thinking biblically, is that pointing to something greater than Canaan, or is that the Canaan sort of the big idea of the Bible for this God's place? Is it pointing to something more? Well, in Hebrews, they refer right back to this. The writer of the Hebrews in Hebrews chapter 11 says, by faith, when he was called, by Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance. He went out not knowing where he was going, right? So it was just what we saw, chapter 12. He didn't know where he's going. But by faith, he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise, for he was looking for a city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. So he receives, he comes into this promised land, but he doesn't receive it, and he's looking ahead for something greater, this heavenly city, this city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God, this heavenly thing. Well, okay, well, is that city like just Jerusalem? Is that what he was looking for? I mean, was that the promised land still there? Well, that same chapter ends this way. Now, remember Hebrews chapter 11, it lists all these people. It starts with Abraham, and then it goes on all the conquerors of Israel, the judges that ruled Israel. They received the land. They received all the promises, but it ends this way. And all these people that gained their approval through faith, they lived in the land, they conquered the land, they received the land, but it says they did not receive what was promised. That land was not the promise, because God had provided something better for us. You see that? God provided something better for us so that apart from us, they would not be made perfect. So the land promise, even to Abraham, was pointing to Canaan, but even then, it said that's not the fulfillment. There's something better that we're all going to receive. Not them separate from us, but something for all of us. So God's special place is ultimately going to be this new heavens and the new earth. We see in 2 Peter 3 and this idea of the whole earth being restored, a new place. So Canaan's a picture of that land. But it's ultimately, we're going to see this, it's a greater picture. The fulfillment is when it's perfected. Not just even when they occupy all of the land of Canaan. So as we think of Abraham's pilgrimage, going into the land of promise, following God, that's to be an encouragement to us. In the record, Abraham doesn't own any of the land. The only bit of land he owns is the grave site for his wife. And so we can have a sense of connecting to that. We're wandering in this world, right? We have a promised land for us, a new heavens and a new earth, but we don't, in a sense, own any of this. We haven't received any of that promise. God's special place is a place promised to us, just like it was promised to Abraham, and we wander. As long as we hold on to that faith as Abraham did, we share in the same blessings as we move ahead towards the promised land. So the idea of special place is a big idea. This is a special land, but we just don't want to focus only on Canaan. We want to point ahead to see the big picture of how we fit into this special place. All right, but now let's go back to Genesis 12 and think, what can we learn about these words, from these words, about God's special people? Where do we see anything about God's special people here? This might be a little more straightforward. What do you think? He's going to make you into a great nation. So what we can, at least from the very beginning, right, this is the shadowy stuff, but he's saying, I'm going to make you a nation. I'm going to bless you and make your name great, and I'm going to bless you. So the first thing we see about this people, it says, God, it's not just for you, but I'm going to make you into a great nation. So your family, that's a very focused point of the God's special people, is a family of Abraham. And that's going to be important for the all old covenant, this massive thing. But is there anything broader than that we're going to see from this? Maybe, again, hinting, this is not really super clear. Sue? Exactly. And so, and now, from the new covenant, we're looking back at that, we're seeing how this is fulfilled. This is pretty shadowy, not a lot of information, but we see a hint here that not only is it for that one family, or for that Abraham's family, but for all the families of the earth through the one descendant. And we're going to see that Jesus Christ being the one descendant, through him, all the families of the earth will be blessed. So even there, the special people of God, even at the very beginning, it's not just all focused on Abraham, but there's a hint of a broader picture of God's special people. I want you to see one more thing about God's special people here. And I don't want you to miss that when you look at this. Something's being highlighted about God's special people. And there's something where he says, I will make you into a great nation. Now, what is God highlighting? If you remember the verse before, what is chapter 11 ends describing Abraham and Sarah. And he says, I'm going to make you into a great nation. Why is that? Should that be somewhat startling, or like, what is it? How are you going to do that, Ron?
But
they're both old, right? Right. So that doesn't. And she's barren, right? And that's so he's saying to an older man, and there's going to be they're in like 70s probably here. There's going to be over 100 when he actually has the baby. And she's barren. The only thing we know about Sarah at this point is she's barren. She's not able to have children. And he says, "I'm going to make you a great nation. I'm going to bless you." And again, it keeps coming back to, what is that highlighting? You can't help. You can't do it. You don't have a way to help with this. God has to do it. It's God has to work to make a people for himself. God demonstrates his power to make a people for himself. You can't add anything to that. We're going to see God's the response in a minute, but let's just see God's power being displayed. He's saying, "I'm going to do it. And I'm taking someone barren, and I'm going to make them into a great nation to demonstrate my power, to demonstrate my prerogative in this." So that's what we can some of the things we can see about God's people. When God's special rule, let's go back to here first. From the very beginning, what would we see about God's rule here? There's nothing really highlighted about God's rule, but what would you say about God's rule? If the God's special people and God's place under God's rule, would we see anything about God's rule from this? Paul? Right. So that's my mind went there too. But there's one thing even earlier. If you're ruling, what do you do when you rule? You command, right? I'm telling you what to do, and that's the first thing he does, right? The rule is assumed. I've at this point even, I've chosen you, Abraham, to be my person, and I'm ruling over you. I'm going to direct you. Now, the faith response we're going to talk about in a minute, but he's already ruling. He's like, I'm giving you direction. And then, Paul, you're exactly right. Right? He's, I'm going to do it. And there's a lot of I's in here, right? I'm going to bless you. I'm going to curse those who curse you. I'm going to protect you. I'm going to provide for you. His rule is this rule of blessing, a rule of protection, a rule of safety, a rule of goodness. And so even from the very beginning, God is asserting his rule over his people. And that rule is a rule of blessing. I will go where I go, tell you, this is the way of blessing. This is the way of safety. This is the way that's good for you. And so we see that from the very beginning. But we also, if we think of Genesis 17, 17, now this is, he's establishing his covenant. He's been making things more formal in both Genesis 15 and Genesis 17. But in 17 verse 7, he says, "I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants and after you, your descendants after you, throughout their generations, for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your descendants after you." And so here he's saying, I will be your God. And here really clearly, what is his rule? His rule is a rule of totality. I will be your God. You will be my people. This is God's rule over his people. And this is an amazing thing. And all the people in all the world and all the nations in all the world, God chose a people and said, I'm going to be your God and I'm going to bless you specially. And this is the way of blessing. But there's a key thing with Abraham that you guys touched on, Ron touched on right at the very beginning and hits in what Rob was saying. When you think of Abraham, the key ingredient that when we think of Abraham to help us understand what it is to be in the kingdom, what's fundamental to be a part of that kingdom, the key ingredient is faith, the faith response. And that's very much highlighted in Abraham. And remember Genesis 15. Now this is Abraham, this is when he's going to have that vision at the end of this chapter. But Abraham's complaining to God that he doesn't have a child yet. And God recommits himself. He says, though Abraham's old, he says, he takes Abraham outside and he says to Abraham, look at the heavens, count the stars if you're able to count them. So shall your descendants be. And then Abraham believed in Yahweh, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. Yahweh reckons it to Abraham as righteousness. And Abraham believes God. And this is one of those just fundamental, foundational verses. And Paul builds on this in Paul's writings of the New Covenant, New Testament. He believed, and it was counted to him as righteousness. In Romans 4 and Galatians 3, Paul references this very verse to show to us the only way for us to be right with God, the only way for us to have a right relationship with God is to respond with faith. God builds his people with his own power. We can't add anything to it. So we have to receive what he has done. God does it all. So as God rules over us, we receive that. We believe it. We trust in it. We respond to it. Faith is so much even where God's rule is so complete that even our faith is a response to his blessing us. Now, I want to make a point here just real quick about faith in the Old Covenant and the New Covenant. So you think of when you think of the Abraham's covenants, they were required to do something. What were they required to do? Do you remember? In the covenant says this in chapter 17, if you're going to be a covenant people, you got to do this to your sons. Circumcision. Okay, yeah, I'll know it. But that was the big thing that he highlights, right? You could do a lot more with Moses, but for Abraham, you had to be circumcised. And if you weren't, you're excluded. So we could think, so that circumcision, that's what's getting it. But no, circumcision by itself wasn't enough. Abraham believed. Faith is what was the required response, but faith always leads to obedience. And obedience, in that covenant structure, that was circumcision. Faith is always going to lead to obedience. If faith doesn't lead to obedience, then you don't actually have faith. Now, you can do things to do some obedience stuff, like I'm going to just do this outward thing without faith, and that's no good. But you can never have faith in that obedience, because if you don't truly believe, or if you're not obeying, then you haven't really truly believed. Faith is always going to have an outworking. And so for the Old Covenant, for Abraham here, the response of faith was the obedience and circumcision. And then the Mosaic Law was going to have a whole structure. But again, the same thing was true. You had to believe God. You had to respond to God with faith, and then you obey in the covenant structure in which you were given. So they responded with the Old Covenant. We're in the New Covenant. So faith is still the main thing. You have to believe in God, but then you respond with prayer. Jeff, you have something to add there?
I was going to say, yeah, that's the point that he makes really in Romans 4, where he says, how did he receive this righteousness? Was it circumcision or uncircumcision?
Right. Right, so it has to be faith. And then we look to God, to how do you want me to respond? He's our God, we're his people. Faith is always going to fuel us to obey, to respond. That's James's whole point, right? So faith without works is dead. So it always leads to works. Now, can we get mixed up and think, so the works are earning my salvation? Yeah, but is that right? No, it's wrong. We have to be able to hold those things together. Faith is the requirement. Faith. Is my trusting and resting in God, but true faith will always lead to obedience. It doesn't earn it. That's what it does. That's the life we live, the life of obedience. Chuck?
Yeah, just a quick word about that James 2 passage where James says faith without works is dead, but he cites Abraham as believing God and God reckoning it to him as righteous. That's in chapter 15.
Right.
He doesn't offer up Isaac until chapter 22.
Right.
So clearly he was justified before he did the works. The works have been
right. So the works are like, the tree without the fruit of the tree. These pictures of the actions that we live, the actions that we do display the hearts that we have, the truth of our hearts. And so the faith is a required thing. Okay, let me see where else we have here for Abraham. Okay, I think that's going to be good. I think we're going to move on to Isaac, I think. Now we're going to talk about the sacrifice, but I want to do that in the context of Isaac. So Abraham finally has this son Isaac. So is Isaac the promised son? Now this is kind of a trick question because it's both. But in what way is Isaac the promised son? This is an easy part. Paul.
In the way that
exactly, and as opposed to Ishmael, right? So is he the problem? Yes, right. So remember, they went Hagar his maid, and let's do our God's not doing it. Let's do it our way. We're gonna make his people for him. Did that work out? No, they got Ishmael, got all kinds of problems. But then God says to Abraham, because remember in Genesis 17, Abraham saying, sure, we're gonna have children. You got Ishmael here, and God's like, no, that was your folly. But Sarah, your wife, will bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. So is Isaac the promised son? Yes, he is the line of promise, this promised son. But does he receive the fullness of the promise? Does Isaac actually end up owning any more of the land? No, he doesn't own the land either, much like Abraham. He's a child of the promise. He's in the line of the promise, but he's not ultimately the promised son, as we understand from the new covenant being ultimately that being Jesus Christ, where he is the seed of Abraham, being Jesus. So certainly he is the promised child as opposed to Ishmael, but he's not receiving the fullness, the fulfillment of the promise, which is we're going to see that fulfilled in Jesus. All right, so now let's work through thinking of Isaac's life, things that happened in his life. This is a little bit tricky. I've been thinking about this a lot, and I realize you might not get some of this. So we'll look at some passages, see if we can figure out. Well, what do we see about God's place being highlighted in God's life? Anybody off the bat? And then I have a couple of places, some texts I can show you, and then I'll make it more clear. All right, let me show you. Okay, go ahead, Murray. No, lots of wrong answers, but... Sure, right. So we're to the end. So I thought of two places in Isaac's life, not sometimes not him speaking, but in his life where God's place is being highlighted. The first one, before we get to the end, at the beginning and the end, I thought were the ones I thought of. So the first one is when Abraham was trying to get a wife for Isaac. So Isaac, are you an older guy, right? And Abraham's telling his servant, go back to my family and get a wife for my family. And the servant says, okay, I'll do that. But what if no woman will come back with me? Should I take Isaac back there? And how does Abraham respond? Beware that you do not take him back there. Right? He's like, look, if they won't come back, you're free of the oath. You're free of whatever. You just don't take him back there. Because at the very beginning of Isaac's story, it was highlighted to us is the importance of Isaac to remain in God's place. And I think this is the key idea when we think of Isaac, the importance of staying in God's place. Don't take him back there. Don't leave God's place. This is where we need to be. Paul?
Could that be an extension of a strong idea of federalism in Abraham's mind? Where Abraham was told to come out of his family's land, and for Isaac, his descendants, to return would be a disobedience.
Absolutely. And so that would be like, yeah, almost over a complete rejection. And so this, I think, even stronger. Like, don't go back to where you're from. But at the end, it's a different thing. So I think that's true. I think that's right. Don't go back. But at the end of his life, there's a famine again, all these famines. And he goes to Gerar, and he's staying with the king of Abimelech. And God speaks to him. And then God says something different. He says, don't go down to Egypt. Now, so that's not going back. This is just going away. Don't go to Egypt, but stay in the land which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and to your descendants I will give these lands. And I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. And I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven. And will give your descendants to all the lands. And by your descendants, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. So here he's reiterating the blessings, the covenant he made with Abraham. God is. He's reiterating, but in that reiteration, he's saying, stay in the land. This is the place where I want you to be. Don't go down to Egypt. Stay here. It's like, don't go back. Don't go back. Don't reject things, but also don't go someplace else. Stay in the land. And that's, if you think of where is God's place being highlighted in Isaac's life, I think this is there's clearly some place where the blessings in Isaac's life in the land, but this highlighting don't leave is this important part. Stay where God wants you. Stay in the land, God's place. But now we think of God's people. Now, God's people, this I think is, once you think of it, is more clear. What about a theme about God's people is being highlighted in Isaac's life? And this has to do with his children. So if a theme of God's people is you see it being chosen in Abraham's life, something about God's people and how God interacts with his people is highlighted in Isaac's life, especially with his children. So look at this verse and tell me what you think. God speaking to Rebekah, he says, two nations are in your womb, two peoples will be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other. The older shall serve the younger. What is this highlighting about God's people? What do you think? I hear mumbling, but nobody's brave enough to say it. Election, right? So this is highlighting God's electing prerogative, right? This is Paul. The Apostle Paul is going to refer this back in later in Romans 9, right? He refers very clearly, he says, but Rebekah also, when she had received twins by one man, our father Isaac, for through the twins were not yet born, for though the twins were not yet born, and had not done anything good or bad, so that God's purpose, according to his choice, would stand, not because of works, but because of him who calls. It was said to her, the older will serve the younger, just as it is written, Jacob I have loved, but Esau I hated. So here you see what's highlighted about this is this prerogative of God to choose. And Paul brings a lot of clarity. We're back in Genesis, there's not a whole lot there as far as to what's God doing here. He's just saying this is what's happening. The older will serve the younger. But when Paul interprets that for us, he's saying this is God's purpose, so that God's purpose according to his choice would stand. He's making it clear it's not about works. They hadn't been born yet. But it's because of God's purpose, because of the one who calls. So God's highlighting in a very, very interesting way. Like this is a picture of God choosing one and not choosing another one. Because he's highlighting through this his prerogative to choose. So God's people is God's chosen people. And that's highlighted in Isaac's life. Stay in God's place is God's chosen people. Murray?
I think it may be good to that thing, but the remarkable thing about that is clearly, because they're in the womb.
Right.
So clearly, their choice is of God, not of anything.
Exactly. Right. Because in Abraham, you saw the choice too. God chose you, Abraham. You come out. Right. And you can see of all the nations, of all the people, he chose one person. But then it's highlighted here because it's that picture of they're in the womb. And so it's like God's clarifying. Is there any way you could think you have something to add to this? He's like, no, God chose Jacob. But not Esau. And so I think that's right. That's why I think this is a highlighting that the electing reality of God's purpose. God chooses his people. And so we can see that more and more clearly with this example. Then God's rule, and when I think of God's rule, this is where I thought, the sacrifice. When you think of this sacrifice, So I think of Isaac's life. I'm putting this in Isaac more than Abraham, although Abraham's the one who's referenced, the one believing. But Isaac is this is in Isaac's life. I mean, he's the one that's going to be put on the altar. What does this teach us about God's rule? It says, God says, take your son, your only son whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains, which I will tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, splint wood for the burnt offering, and arose and went to the place of God, which God had told him. What does this highlight about God's rule? Paul?
The man absence of Israel. I mean, Isaac was Abraham's only hope for inheritance. And he said, give that to me. Give me your only hope.
That's right. And that's, man, it's like everything is God's. And God said, I promise to give you this. And through this is all these things are going to happen. Give them back to me. This is your not only that, not only what I promised, this is what you and your wife have longed for 100 years. Give them back to me. Everything. God's rule is absolute over every bit of our lives. Now take that and put Isaac in the picture. Is that even pictured more fully? Give everything back. Isaac gets up on the altar and doesn't fight his dad. Everything is your whole self is given to God. You get your Romans 12, your whole self on the altar. So God's rule is absolute over every bit of your every hope and every dream, every longing, every decision. We're all ruled 100%. God's children are ruled 100% by God. He rules over every bit of our lives. But what also we see, what's so beautiful about this, is not just this cold, I will rule. I'm going to demand everything from you, but he gives everything that he demands. What did Abraham believe? Abraham believed that God would provide himself for himself the lamb for the burnt offering. So the two of them walked together. Where's the lamb? God will provide. God will provide. We see in the New Testament where it says God believed that he could even raise him up from the dead. I mean, Abraham believed that God could raise him from the dead. He believed God. He said, you've given me the son. You've promised the descendants through this son. So I know that he's not going to be lost. I'm trusting you. I can sacrifice him up, and I know either you'll raise him from the dead or you'll provide something, but you will provide. And when we see God's rule, we see God demands everything from us, but God provides everything that he requires. It's overwhelming, but he gives us everything. And we believe, when we believe that, we're stepping into the place of faith where we're able to live with God, for God, without fear, because we trust him that he will provide. Now, if we just look at what God provides, we get our Bibles out and we go, wow, how can I do all this? Like, this is overwhelming. How can I do this? But when I see, God, you will give me everything you provide. When I step into obedience to love my wife when it's a struggle, to love my husband when it's a struggle, to love my children, to love my neighbors, to work hard, to trust you for these things, to know that God will give all that help when I believe him, then we're freed, we're liberated. And that's the struggle. That's the struggle to believe this is true. That's what Abraham did. He set up before us that he believed that God would provide, and he found that peace to obey God. So God is now, you think of this. This is not God like trying to humiliate Abraham. Like, look what I can make Abraham do. I can give him a baby. I can take it away. This is fun. He's not humiliating Abraham. He's not dominating Abraham. He's liberating him. He's teaching him to believe. I'm going to give you everything I require. Just trust me. He's teaching him to believe my yoke is easy. Follow me. Give everything to me. It's okay. So he's leading Abraham, and as we read and we believe, he's leading us into a place of rest and trust in God's rule. So we have God's special place. Don't leave God's special place. We have God's special people he chooses, he elects. God's special rule under his rule, where he rules over every bit of us and he provides all that we need. So we see that in Isaac. All right, so then that moves on. Now we'll follow into Jacob. So Abraham had Isaac, the son of promise. Isaac had two sons, but only one Jacob was a son of promise. He was the covenant was with Jacob. And then Jacob has 12 sons. We're not going to get into all the shenanigans for getting 12 sons for Jacob, but he has all these sons. And now here, it's not like this is any one, is the particular. These are going to be the 12 tribes of Israel. These are all now starting to expand into God's promised people. And so he has these 12 sons. He has his own story. Of course, the way he manipulated his brother to get his blessing, the way he deceived his father, the birthright, and then deceived his father to get the blessing. The way his father-in-law then deceives him. All kinds of fun things we could think about for Jacob. But what moves the story forward towards the Exodus book and towards the end of Genesis is the story of Joseph. Joseph is what's moving the story forward. So we're going to move in. Jacob's name is changed to Israel, another important thing. But Joseph and Benjamin had the same mother. Rachel died giving birth to Benjamin. But that was the favored wife, and Joseph was the favored son, and that causes all kinds of problems. All right, so now let's hone in on Joseph for a little bit, and well, it might start in a little early. That'd be nice. Now Joseph, he has this dream, and he relates it to his brothers, right? I have another dream. Behold, the sun and the moon, the 11 stars were bowing down to me. He relates this to his father and his brothers, and his fathers rebuked him and said to him, "What is the dream that you've had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves down to you, to the ground?" Well, his brothers were jealous of him, but his fathers kept the saying in mind. He remembered this. Remember the story of Joseph. What happens? So his brothers, they kidnap him, throw him in the pit, sell him into slavery. He's Potiphar. He serves Potiphar. He's raised up faithful over all of Potiphar's household, and his wife, lies about him, and he gets thrown into prison. That's up and down, up and down. In prison, he's raised up to be a helper in the prison, and finally he's released, but interpreting dreams, he comes to the point where he is the second highest ruler of all of Egypt. This is an amazing thing. And why did all that happen? And we can think about that whole story, but this is such a it's just a beautiful, amazing story of up and down of what God is doing. But let's focus on one aspect of that story. And this is what I think is the most important aspect of that story, is how does he respond to his brothers? How does Joseph interpret all of these events for us? And that's what's most important. In Genesis 45, towards the end of that whole story, right, he saved his brothers come, and his father comes finally, and they're all being saved as through this massive famine comes. And Joseph says to his brothers, come closer to me. And they're all ashamed. Like, oh, we tried to kill you, and now you're this powerful person, you're going to kill us. He says, they come closer. I'm your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. Don't be grieved or angry with yourselves, because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. Then Genesis 50, verse 20, at the very end, as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive. So we'll remember that story. Now let's think about these three things, God's people and God's place under God's rule. What can we get about God's people when we think about this story? What do we learn about? We've seen God's electing power and purpose. He has a special people. But now we're getting into the story of people doing stuff. What do we learn about God's people from this? Any thoughts? Sue? He does. He's going to provide for his people. He takes care of his people. That's certainly important. We need to trust God. Mark? Well, I think that's right. I mean, at least in the fact that we see if these 12 are representative of God's people, most of what they're doing, and you can get into the whole aspect of what was Reuben doing or with these people, they were messing up. They were doing bad stuff. They were not doing good things. But God uses even their mistakes to accomplish his purposes. Yeah, Beth? Yeah. So even when we're totally blowing it, right? God's and that's the God's rule, I think, part really mirrors here. But Dale?
God's not being reactionary here. He's been told from the start that he's sending Joseph and he
right.
Used it for good.
Exactly.
The same way that they meant it for evil.
Right. It's not God looking at it and saying, oh, no, now Joseph is my man. Now he's in slavery. What do I do? Oh, let me do this cool thing. No, from the very beginning, God was purposing that. Rob?
God's people must have patience.
Right, this took a long time. It's a long time. But let's not miss Joseph, too, because he's also one of God's people. What else can we see from God's people? Not only does he use us when we're screwing up, but he does use us through his faithfulness. God has used a faithful man to accomplish his work. Joseph was faithful, and he believed God. Allison.
And that faithful man had to suffer a long time.
A long time. Right, he was faithful when it wasn't easy, and it didn't seem like things were going his way. I mean, for a long time, he kept being faithful. Oh, let me be faithful. I'm doing well. No. I'm going to be in, my brothers just sent me to be a slave. I'll be faithful here. Okay, now I'm going into jail. I did all the right things, and it seemed like God just punished me. Now, how many people, or have you thought that? Or you've heard someone, you're counseling, you're loving somebody, and think, I tried to do all the right stuff, and it feels like God's punishing me. Isn't that what Joseph was feeling? Or couldn't he? I mean, if you just looked at it objectively, all the right stuff, bang. You try to stand up, bang. And he's just trying to figure out how to figure life out. His knees his legs get knocked out from under him time and time again. But he kept being faithful. So God's people here, what we see from God's people, that patience, God takes a long time with his people. When we're screwing up, he's using it. He has a plan for a purpose for their screwing up. Their faithfulness, he uses their faithfulness to accomplish his purposes. So one, we should look at this and say, it doesn't matter what I do. Because on one hand, you can kind of say that because God's God. He can do whatever he wants. But it's through faithfulness. I mean, Joseph was wonderfully blessed. It's through faithfulness that we see God using us. And he can use our mess ups. But let's not need to let that, allow that to be a, an excuse for us. It's God's faithfulness. This is where we're finding blessing. I mean, those the brothers went through all their fear and misery, wondering what they had done. But Joseph was able to be that fountain of blessing because he was in God's will, doing what God, being faithful to God's command for him. So there we see some things about God's people. They mess up, they struggle, but God uses them. He provides for them. He plans for them. So very good. That was great. So what's interesting here, we think about God's place. Now, what's happening here with the whole place idea? Right, but that's what's interesting about this is before God said came to Jacob and said don't go to Egypt, right? Or was that Isaac, right? Don't go to Egypt. Or was it Isaac? Anyway, Isaac. Don't go to Egypt. Stay here, right? But now we're talking about Jacob. But here now in this story, Jacob would not leave until God came to Jacob and said, "Don't fear. Go to Egypt. Go see your son." And I think the most important thing I think we're going to talk about, another aspect of this is, what did God say when he said to Abraham, go to the place where I'm going to show you? He didn't tell him where he was going. He said, follow me. Go where I'm going to tell you to go. Ultimately, God's place is going to be wherever God tells us it's going to be. He says, this is the place I want you to be. We want to follow God. And what he's doing here, they're going to be in God's will. They're following God to Egypt. He said, go to Egypt. God meant this for good, to bring them to Egypt, because he wanted that. Well, why does God want that little family to go to Egypt? What happens in Egypt? Rob?
They row tremendously, and then they plunder the Egyptians and leave.
Exactly. And you remember at the end of Genesis, you know, when Joseph's talking to them about what they should do, remember, what did he tell them to say to the Pharaoh? Do you remember? About the family. Say you're something, because they're so odious. Shepherds, right? So they are shepherd. I'm going to go stay in the land of Goshen. Stay your shepherds, because it's odious to them. They'll keep you separate. So here, now this is all God's purpose. And working through this, I want this little little family in this land that I promised them to go off to this other land, Egypt, to be a little incubator. And you're going to be separate. And you're going to grow into this mighty nation. And ultimately, the pressures are going to be put upon you by slavery. From that, I'm going to deliver you, and you're going to come to know me in a deeper way. Paul?
Well, we also see that it was sin that got the first of them and the rest of them into Egypt, right? And
yeah.
In the same way, they were in captivity in Egypt.
Yep.
And we see that recurring pattern throughout the New Testament that Israel sins, Israel goes into captivity.
Right, that's right. And that's the other thing. What God's purpose is for them to go here, his purpose wasn't for them to stay there. That's not God's special place for them. God's special place, Genesis ends with this word, where Joseph says to his brother, I'm about to die, but God will surely take care of you and bring you up from this land to the land which he promised on oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones up from here. They're in God's will, but this is not where God's going to keep them. And you're exactly right, Paul. We're going to see that cycle. Because this came from sin. Even though God used it for good, there's still responsibility with sin. There's still implications. And they're here now, but God's going to bring them back to the promised land. Allison, do you have a comment?
There's also, I think it's the verse in Genesis, because I was talking to Abraham, and he was explaining the timing of when God said, I'm going to take care of you, and the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete, so there's
right.
Judgment coming, and there's wrath that he's going to pour out on that place.
Yeah.
And therefore, there's a timing to it. And I just think that applies to us a lot. God is doing something, but there's a timing that we don't always like or
right.
know or appreciate or
yeah.
value.
Right. And it's probably going to lead us into our own place of difficulty, and we have our own sin that's led us there. So God's dealing with our sin, and that doesn't mean everything is always one-to-one, but we have our own sin, and God's dealing with our sin, and he brings us through those trials and in this difficulty. He's going to expose the hearts of the whole nation of Israel through all this, these pressures, but God, we wait for God. In God's timing, he brings us out. Paul?
There's a strong theme throughout Genesis of federalism and God's dealing with people according to the faith of their father.
Yeah,
their
yeah,
father.
Yeah.
Sons of Abraham
right.
faith.
Right.
And then in Romans 11 it talks about Israel being beloved because of the promises to their fathers.
Right. Yeah, and that keeps coming back. And then you see that in David. We'll see that later, that because of David, because of your sons will be blessed. All that federalism is very important, right? We're related to, and ultimately you see that in the greatest picture is Adam and Christ. And are you in Adam? Are you in Christ? What is the ultimate federal head? But that's a theme that in smaller ways we found throughout. Bob? Right. Well, because he would say, no, you're of your father, the devil.
Right.
Because there's a lot, there's to that, because there's levels of that federalism. Right. That's right. So we have to understand that. I mean, that's why I think when you see the big picture of Adam Christ, and then you see how God's working, but because there's still through that covenant blessing as it relates back, and there's how that relates, because those are important. Because even David is not all of his sons. It is usually a line or a path of that chosen seed. And all this goes back, actually we'll talk about that in just a minute. Chuck, did you?
Yeah, just along the same lines, that the corporate identity is balanced with the individualism.
Right.
Passage like Ezekiel 18 talks about alternate generations.
Right.
Wicked father, righteous son, he has a wicked son.
Right.
Each man will bear the consequences.
Absolutely.
So those two are just held in balance.
They are. And I mean, there's God often blesses, and there's, I mean, well, think about that. I mean, just the practicality of the Bible and life. If you are a faithful father and you pass down that blessing to your children, you teach them to be self-controlled and teach them about the Bible, they're going to have blessing in their life. Now, they still have to respond for justification, but that blessing, that can pass on generations of them just being having material blessings, lots of safety, but there's still an individualism. How are we related to God? For Abraham, it was counted to him as righteousness because of his faith. Now, God was going to bless many others through that blessing, but there's still that individual relationship, which you're exactly right. We have to have that. There's an individual aspect. For you to be right, you have to believe on Jesus Christ. But there's blessings of God can often be related to the family, to how that pours down, all kinds of ways. And we see that in the Bible. We see that even just in families. All right. We move on. So we had God's place, God's people, God's place, and God's rule. And here I think we probably covered this enough already when we talked about his people, but God will accomplish his purposes. God's plans will be accomplished. God doesn't need anybody to accomplish his purposes. He called Abraham. He chose Jacob. God uses his people as he will, and he will accomplish his purposes. And that, when we think of God's rule, it cannot be stopped. And so our sin can't derail God. Like the sin of Adam didn't derail God. Like, oh no, what do I do now? What's my backup plan? God has his purposes, and our sins can't derail it. God is bigger, greater, more wonderful. He rules his people fully and completely. And so there, I mean, that should be a place of trust for us. One, trust to just rest all of ourselves. We can give ourselves wholly to following God, to believing him. But it could also be a place of it calls us to freedom to repentance. Like, I don't have to, oh, I screwed up again, I failed again. That doesn't have to destroy me. That doesn't have to wipe me out so I can't do anything. But I'm free to repent and confess and move on and turn back to God, because God's going to still use me. God's still doing stuff. God's still working. I can trust him. And that frees me, liberates me. The more and more we believe God's rule really is over all of our life and how good that is. But before I want us to leave Genesis, I do want to focus on one last thing, and that's Judah, the other son that I want to talk about of Israel. When Israel's blessing Judah in 49, he says this, Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp from the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches, he lies down as a lion. As a lion, who dares rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. So here I just want you to point out this prophecy here of Judah. this blessing upon him that he will be a ruler. And think of that, his hands will be on the neck of his enemies. Here, you know, in the beginning in Genesis 3, we saw Satan being crushed by the seed of the woman, right? And here we're seeing the seed of the seed of the woman through Abraham, Judah, pointing ahead to Jesus, be the one who will ultimately crush the enemy. His hand will be upon the neck of his enemy, crushing his enemy. He is the lion, this lion of Judah, that will rule and reign. The scepter shall not depart from him, and he'll have the obedience of his people. So here at the very beginning, now this is, again, this is shadowy, this isn't super clear, but we have a pointing ahead a picture that what he said in Genesis 3:15, there's going to be victory, there's going to be deliverance. And that hint, we're getting a clearer picture through this line of Judah, this promised family, now this promised line through Judah, there's going to be a ruler, a lion to come and deliver them. And there we're going to see Jesus ultimately from that line, Jesus, the Lion of Judah, the ruler who will deliver his people ultimately, who will defeat the enemy, and the last enemy being death. While this isn't not clear, it's a shadow, it gets clearer and clearer as we work through the old covenant until the day spring comes, and in the light of Jesus, truth is displayed, and we see it really clearly. We can understand all of these little pieces because we see Jesus. And in the light of Jesus, in the truth of Jesus, he fulfills this. He is this, and it all makes sense. We see him doing it, and he defeats our enemies, and he completes the promise. And he is leading us, his people, chosen by his power, to be under his rule, to follow him to his place, which is ultimately the new heavens and the new earth. Now, the Genesis is all about the beginning of this. It's the beginning of this plan of salvation. But all these pieces are there. It's going to be explored and expanded until we see Jesus in the fulfillment. And the picture of the new earth as we're moving towards him, as we still are in the far country, until God brings us to that place where we are in the new heavens and the new earth with him, perfectly under his rule forever and ever. Well, that's what I have. Does anybody have any comments? We have about a few minutes, which is not bad to be early. Mark first and then Paul. Mark? Yep. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Paul?
And just another thing, like this chapter doesn't give you just blessing Judah, it's just blessing all of
them. Right.
He pronounces things over them that are fulfilled generations and generations and generations later.
Yeah.
So it's more the same picture.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's why you see, the more you dig into Genesis, the more you see how it's just flooding into the rest of what God was doing and going to be doing. This is just really is the beginning, and that's why I want to take time to think through it here. Okay. Well, next week, Caleb Jabella will be here, and so he'll be speaking to us. But the following week, then we'll start with Exodus, and we'll jump into Exodus. Okay. All right. Oh, yes, Sandy. I'll say that again in the morning worship, but $8,300 we raised, and we're gonna supplement that to have a $10,000 check. But we're really encouraged by the generosity of the church. But yeah, it was very good. All right, let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you that you love us and that you have revealed yourself to us. We thank you that you have been working in the world to draw from this broken world a people to yourself, to be their God. To rule them, to bless them, and to be with them, and to bring them to be with you into your special place, that we might be with you, to know you forever and ever. And I pray, God, that more and more we would know that, we would believe it, that you would help us, O Lord, to be about the work you've given us to do, to see ourselves primarily as ruled by you, owned by you, belonging wholly to you, so that we are doing your work in our families, in our neighborhoods, at church, wherever we are. Would you bless us to live more fully for you, as we long for that day when you come back to make all things right. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.